Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. You know, despite Australia's relatively small population size, which, by the way, around 26 million people in Australia, it's about two-thirds the population of California, and I believe that's about 1/3% of the global population. Despite that relatively small population, they sure pump out a lot of climate-related and collapse-related experts. And they're always in the news regarding collapse. I have never been to Australia. It's a dream of mine to go one day. As a kid, I went to New Zealand. I know they can't be compared at all, really, in any way. But that's the closest geographically I've ever been. I also have a surprisingly large number of listeners to the podcast from Australia. So I'm not sure what it is that makes, you know, Australians more open to the idea of collapse. I mean, my guess is it's that Australia is one of the hardest hit countries when it comes to collapse, and that makes people more aware. And that's an interesting question, because, you know, people talk about how you won't notice collapse or you won't accept collapse until it's happening to you directly. Many of us in developing countries are so protected on an individual basis, but I think Australia is one of those developed countries where the impacts are felt greater, and perhaps it's become pretty difficult to ignore. That said, I'd be interested to hear from anyone who lives in Australia your view on this. Is it a mainstream topic there, or is there as much denialism as everywhere else? All right, well, that's all just kind of an anecdotal tangent, but the reason I bring this up is a listener emailed me last week. His name was Kendall. Thank you, Kendall. He sent me a link to Sarah Wilson's TEDx talk, her speech. I had seen it floating around a little bit, seen it posted on the subreddit, but thought, hey, I should actually take a minute and listen to this. And then from there, coincidentally, I noticed some new papers that have come out, both from the government of Australia, as well as from other climate and collapse researchers there as well. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to touch briefly on the paper. This paper is 1,000 pages long, right? I just did an episode on Finland's future scenarios regarding collapse, and that thing was like 163 pages long. This one's got that beat by like 7 times the size, and it's only really discussing climate. This paper was released later than it was supposed to be. It was supposed to come out last year, but there were some delays, mainly because there were some discrepancies around how bad they were expecting climate change to be and what to include in the report. Now, while the Finnish paper discussed futures, some of which contained optimistic scenarios about potential opportunities in the future, this Australian one, which focused on the climate, basically just talked about the different degrees of bad that the climate could achieve by, I think it was 2090. And it ranged basically from where we sit now, right around 1.2 degrees Celsius above the baseline, all the way up to 3 degrees Celsius above the baseline. Now, there will be people listening to this saying 3 degrees as the worst case scenario is optimistic, that runaway climate change could equal 4 degrees or more. At this point, the scientific consensus does not sit in that realm. I think that's more, from extrapolations and some will argue hyperbole from collapse-aware folk. But it also, you know, there are scientists who claim that. James Hansen and others are saying that a future at that degree of warmth, 4 degrees plus, is where we're headed due to tipping points and accelerating feedback loops. So I'm not here to say whether or not that is going to happen, whether or not that's true. But the scientific consensus, as it was shown in this paper, again, ranged from 1.2 degrees up to 3 degrees. It's fascinating to me that governments are now so kind of rapidly coming out with these bleak images of the future and kind of asking, what is the point of this? What are they trying to get across? Is it for public awareness? Is it for internal congressional or parliamentary discussions for decision making, or is it just to freak people out? Well, I don't think it's the last one. That's not why I do my podcast. That's not why most people discuss collapse. And so while I'm not going to get into the details of the paper, I am going to talk a little bit about one article from ABC Australia, which talks about the point of this paper. And then I'm going to go from there to talk about the article by Luke Kemp, an Australian collapse researcher, who talks about his views of it as well. So the article talks about the main reason for these reports is basically to help the governments identify the people who are most vulnerable to climate change by looking at things like where they live, their age, health, housing standards, income, and access to cool places, among other metrics. They're basically saying, if we can figure out where this is going to impact us the worst, what are going to be the biggest impacts in each area, then how can we best mitigate? Part of the paper talks about how, you know, over time, deaths due to natural disasters have decreased, not because natural disasters themselves have increased, but because we found ways to mitigate, we found early warnings, those types of things. And so they're saying, if this can be our early warning for us to be able to create future early warnings and for us to be able to mitigate the best possible, start moving people away from dangerous areas or putting in the infrastructure needed to handle it, then at the very least, we could prevent the most death possible from climate change. And so some people will ask, you know, what's the point of playing out a, you know, a 3-degree warming scenario if maybe the scientific consensus at the moment says that we can still beat 2 degrees, right? Or we can stay around 2 degrees. Why would the government be hyperbolic about this? And that is the same question that Luke Kemp addresses. They call him, his nickname is Dr. Doom. And another article by ABC, which discusses him, asks the same question. Is there value in being pessimistic? And this is something I've discussed several times on the podcast. I know it's come up in these daily episodes, and I've brought it up many times in the bonus episodes. And that is just trying to find the right approach for, you know, the attitude to take around the views of the future. And society so often likes to say, you need to be optimistic. We can't be pessimistic in a time like this, because, you know, climate doomerism or collapse doomerism in general is not helpful. It shuts people down. It stops them from trying. It creates this apathy. And I've long been against that thought, that idea. And we're going to talk about some of the reasons that Luke Kemp feels that way as well. So I'm going to read a few parts of this. The article starts by saying, for a guy whose nickname is Dr. Doom, Luke Kemp remains surprisingly cheerful. He says, I'm Australian and basically just a constant happy, happy dog. We do often joke that the field self-selects for people who have a high happiness baseline, just because you kind of have to in order to work in this area. That area is the study of past civilizational collapses and what they can tell us about the future. Kemp is a research associate at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge and has just published a book on the topic. Quote, climate change is one of the drivers which most concerns me going forward. It's already happening, and on top of that, I think people dramatically underestimate just how bad it could get and also how vulnerable we are to it. So it's, you know, this article in particular is Luke taking a look at climate change, and he doesn't really discuss a lot of the other factors here. There are a couple other points that he makes towards the bottom of the article that I will make sure to mention. But the main bulk of what he says regarding climate change is this. He says, I think of the future probabilistically, and there's different futures going forward. I think most of them aren't so good. I'm one you could say is pessimistic about the future, but I'm not fatalistic. I do think there are actually still very good futures available to us. So he points out that the future calls for pessimism. We can't be doing this thing where we say, you know, at the end of every article, there's still time, there's still a chance, we can still, you know, all we have to do is X, Y, and Z, and we're good. Because that creates, according to my own thoughts, and I believe that Luke feels the same way, this idea of someone else will figure it out. If there is a solution, and that solution's being mentioned so nonchalantly here at the end of the article, then it must be something that someone is doing and we'll be fine. If we can see that far ahead and we know it's coming and we know that there's something that can be done to prevent it, then it will be done. But what we're seeing is that that's not happening. Yeah, we have made pledges, right? All we have to do is meet the Paris Climate Accord pledges. Okay, we've already passed those, right? I mentioned earlier that we're at 1.2. Well, that's the long-term average, right? That's the 10-year running average is 1.2 or so degrees above the baseline. But the last 2 years have been above 1.5. The article says, despite some dire warnings, there's an important message. The impacts can be greatly reduced if we can limit the warming of the planet. But will we? Kemp's worldview is one that brings with it criticism from some people in the climate movement who believe optimism and hope are needed to motivate change. But when does a healthy dose of pessimism turn to apathetic fatalism? Despite declaring himself as non-fatalistic, after speaking with Kemp, I'm left with a plethora of end-of-world scenarios that had never crossed my mind. He says, quote, if we manage the Herculean task of decarbonizing by 2050, but we have nuclear war in 2051, we are unfortunately still screws, he said. Hence, there's a need to actually think of all these in tandem. And so he is referencing here the polycrisis, right? Climate change is not all that we're battling, and we are failing the climate change battle. The battle is in dozens, if not hundreds, of combining factors that lead to collapse. He's taking this one, just climate change, and saying, if we do act, yes, we can still mitigate. The future can still be livable. It's unlikely that we will do that. It's unlikely that we can do everything that needs to be done and that people will act together to do that. And that's where, at the bottom of the article, he talks about past collapses and how that influences his thoughts in this conversation. He says, when you think of societal collapses, often vulnerabilities were more important, and the biggest driver of growing fragility in societies is growing wealth inequality. Essentially, inequality in systems and economic exploitation lurk behind every single big existential catastrophe we can think of. And that, to me, is so interesting. He's bringing in some of these other parts of the polycrisis, but he's saying that the biggest vulnerabilities that we have come around equality, exploitation of the economy, you know. So he's talking about corruption and political polarization and divides, and those inequalities between the haves and have-nots create a massive vulnerability. And I think he's right. You know, I think if, as a world and as individual nations, if we were genuinely working together, if we had the end in mind, if we were all working with one sort of united goal, we could definitely avert, you know, the worst of climate change. And we could possibly even avert collapse. But we introduce these massive vulnerabilities by splitting ourselves through power dynamics. And even though that split might be the top 1%, the top 0.1% versus all the rest, they are the ones that hold the power to actually affect change, or in the opposite, to continue the status quo, the issues that are leading us towards collapse. And so from there, it talks about the need, quite frankly, for anger. It talks about the difference between fatalism and realism. And while fatalism isn't necessarily helpful, the realism mixed with a passionate anger about the situation can cause changes. It can help things to improve. It says, earlier this year, a furor erupted over comments made by veteran Canadian environmentalist David Suzuki when he said in an interview, it's too late to stop climate change. I'm saying, as an environmentalist, we have failed to shift the narrative and we are still caught up in the same legal, economic, and political system. The focus on politics, economics, and law are all destined to fail because they are based around humans. The article goes on to say, those comments made headlines and sparked outrage amongst many climate activists who dubbed it climate fatalism, a belief that catastrophe is imminent and unavoidable. There are many critics of climate fatalism who argue it's counterproductive and leads to apathy and inaction. Australian climate analyst and writer Ketan Joshi even went as far as to say it's on par with climate denial. Well, I think that's a bit too far, right? I get why fatalism can be, you know, counterproductive for some, and how you draw the line between fatalism and realism is a nuanced question that, you know, I can't really attempt to answer here. But in its most basic sense, I do agree that if we simply say there is absolutely nothing that can be done at this point and the results will be the same no matter what, well, that's incorrect. there are things that can be done. Now, can I make those changes myself personally? Can I go out and save the world, you know, from the worst of climate change consequences? No, it does take a more united effort. It takes those in power being the ones to make those changes, or for enough of us without the power to create our own power by influencing them. So on a personal level, you know, inwardly, can I be fatalistic? Yes, absolutely. Do I think to myself, the actions aren't going to be taken that need to be taken to mitigate any of this? Yes, absolutely. I think that all the time. Outwardly, can we, you know, shoot for realism and push nonetheless for change? You know, instead of giving up, still try and make the decisions that help influence those who can make the changes. Yes, I think that's also important. And even Joshi, who adamantly, you know, talks against fatalism, he does say he agrees there's a need for pessimism, or some pessimism, when thinking about the climate future. So yeah, it's all a very nuanced mix. And, you know, you may be asking yourself, does this conversation, like, does it really matter? Should we be talking so much about the attitude that we take towards collapse? I think this conversation would have been especially important 20 years ago or 30 years ago. I still think it's relevant today, because as we sort of approach the last years of really being able to make any sort of effort towards it, the more mainstream discussion around it, the better. So these types of articles, I think, are fruitful. I think they're good. But as always, I find it fascinating to see more and more these types of discussions happening in mainstream media. From Sarah Wilson giving a TEDx talk, to there being multiple articles by ABC, you know, about collapse researchers, to governments creating 1,000-page documents about how dire the future looks. These are things that 10 and 20 years ago, I could not have imagined seeing, and with such frequency. It's both, you know, a positive sign, because it shows that people are starting to care about it, and a negative sign, because it's showing that at this point, it's so blatantly in our faces and obviously occurring that the media feels need to pick it up. You know, if it had been 20 years ago, it would have been a look at the future of extrapolating and seeing what could happen if we didn't make change. And today, while some of that is still there, it's mostly a, hey, we are noticing the blatant signs of it happening around us. There's been a paradigm shift in what society is over the last 5 years, and collapse is no longer suddenly, you know, such a strange idea as it once was. All right, that's it for today. See you soon. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.